podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly chess interview show where we talk with accomplished chess players, authors, and personalities about their lives, their careers, and how to improve at chess. Perpetual Chess is brought to you through the generosity of its Patreon and PayPal supporters and by Chessable.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We have a star guest joining us this week. She's had a crazy 2021, as we will discuss. But first and foremost, she is a WGM and an IM with a FIDE rating over 2,400. She's one of the top players in Indonesia and two-time Asian women's champion. She's a Twitch streamer. She streams in both English and her native Indonesian. And aside from her more traditional chess accomplishments, some of you may recognize our guest's name from a crazy story in a cheating scandal involving IM Levi Rosman, aka Gotham Chess, and an Indonesian chess enthusiast. She's been in the media a lot for this, especially in Indonesia, but also here in the States. The story culminated in Irene playing a live match against an alleged cheater in front of 1.25 million online viewers. That's right. That's the number. 10 times bigger than any other live broadcast chess event. So I can only imagine how this has changed her life, and I'm eager to talk about it. But we're not just going to talk about that because Irene has done a lot of media on that topic already. So without further ado, let's bring Irene in. Irene, thank you for joining Perpetual Chess. Irene Sukander, I should say.
Hello, Ben. Thanks for having me on your podcast.
My pleasure. I mean, what a year for you, Irene. And by the way, one more fact from the intro, I should mention you studied in the United States. If anyone's wondering why your English is so good, you got a master's in international relations at Webster. You were there at the same time as Eric Rosen and Ilya Nizhnik. And who else that we might know, Irene?
I was there along with Lee Kwang Lim.
Oh, wow.
Yep, the top Vietnamese player, and also Ray Robson. But when I was there, Lim and Ray, they were doing their bachelor degrees. Lim and I graduated at the same time. So was Eric, because he was there as a transfer student, and he already did 2 years before in, I can't remember his past university, but he did another 2 years in Webster.
Yeah, I believe University of Illinois before that. I had him on the podcast a long time ago, so I should know this. But Lekwang Liam, I believe, has taken over for Susan Polgar at Webster. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. And Susan, as we are speaking right now, she's retiring officially on this day.
Oh, wow. Well, congratulations to her on a great career at Webster and everywhere else, obviously. And Irene, as we talk about Webster, again, we've got this crazy story that you're probably tired of talking about. I do want to talk about it a little, but let's start with your chess, because I'm going to be referring to a great interview you did with our friend Jen Shahadi for US Chess, the Ladies Night podcast, which you guys all should be listening to. And your interview in particular, I think, gives good context of the story with Levi. But I also would like to refer back to a few other things you mentioned. Number one, what's going on with your chess game, where, as Jen and you discussed, you've got one GM norm. You expressed like a palpable urge to get out there and play chess, possibly chase the GM title. So we fast forward, this is about probably 6 weeks after that interview has recorded. Any update on what's been going on with that in your busy life, Irene?
Well, I'm still trying to be focusing myself on chess, of course, because that's the main thing. But what I'm seeing right now myself with chess is that chess is not the only thing that I'm doing. Chess is like the opening door of all the opportunities that I might get and I have gotten already. So right now, even though I'm focusing on chess, but I've also been doing this chess promotion for my country, especially because when I got my WGM title back in 2008, when I was 16, that was also one of my priorities, you know, to bring chess into the girls' world more, because I'm the living proof that I'm a girl and I still can do it. And also, I still can also do my education, because that's important, because that's what most parents think nowadays when they're putting their kids onto some extracurricular activities such as chess. They're thinking that it might not be good for their school and so on, but chess turns out to be very beneficial in every aspect of your life. So right now I'm preparing myself for the World Cup, which will be happening in Russia in July. And me and three other Indonesian players will also be there, two in the men and two in the women, including myself. And from there, we'll see. I'm also planning to play in the Beal Open. I think chess has been resuming again, especially in the coming summer. And that would be a very good plan if that can happen, you know, because we still have to be very cautious about this COVID protocols and all things.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear that you're getting after it. I know with all the attention and the opportunities that you mentioned, I'm sure that there can be some temptation to skip tournaments. So, and the World Cup is always fun. And a tournament like the Beal Open, I'm sure, would also be fun. And speaking of chess in Indonesia, so there was a big write-up on you in the Jakarta Post. I'm sure there's probably more than one write-up, given the nature of the attention you got. But just speaking about the chess culture, they say, ask any Indonesian person about chess, and what comes to mind are not professional players slugging it out at international championships, but rather the image of their father slipping away after dinner time, hanging out with his buddies at the Pas Ronda, chatting over a game of chess. So first of all, you have to tell me what a Pas Ronda is, but also can you talk a little bit more about what the culture has been like there and what you're doing to change it, Irene?
Yeah. Well, Pas Ronda is this thing. It's a small, how do you call it? It's a small building that put for the security people at night, because Indonesia, we have this thing, like every night everyone will, you know, will have their turn to guard the houses areas, and there are some specific people who do that, and this is the place where there will be gathering, you know, like one person will be guarding the A section or B section and so on. So while they're waiting for the sun to be rising, they usually, you know, spending their time playing cards or chess and something like that. So Pas Ronda is that one. And the culture of chess itself in Indonesia is actually, I would say, underappreciated compared to the Western world, because chess is actually pretty big in Indonesia. It's been played over so many years. And I recently learned this, although I must have known this already from years ago. But before the pandemic, my last tournament was in Amsterdam, in that of the chess tournament, the GM Nome tournament. And I went to the Max Nieuwe Centrum, where I could find so many historic stories, pieces, articles, and everything else. And there is one section which written about the Indonesian players in the past, where Max went to Indonesia, and then he went to this specific part of Sumatra, where it is very known until now that they will produce so many good players just by, you know, they don't play theoretical chess, but their instinct for tactical chess was just very good, and that attracted Max to visit them and then play some simultaneous chess. And that time, Indonesia was, of course, under the Dutch colonies. So I think that's one of the reason of the visit. But nevertheless, this already shown that Indonesia has great passion for chess. And it is just about time for the Indonesian women's chess to also rising, you know, just like in the men. And when I became WGM in 2008, I think it was one of the moments where I could turn the table around, especially for women's chess here in Indonesia. And now we can see so many girls playing chess. And in the past few years, also the achievements that our women's team have gotten, they are actually greater than the men's team. So what I'm doing for Indonesian chess is just basically promoting the women's chess itself, because I see there are so many potential in it that has to be explored. And And even though this is not my task to do it, but I have some sort of moral responsibility that I have to do it.
Wow. Well, that's admirable. And I know that you've mentioned in previous interviews how much work it took for you to get to where you are. I know you talked about how you worked like super long days as a kid. So anyone who thinks like you're leading a charmed life because you're already one of the best chess players in your country, and then now you've got this sort of injection of celebrity based on this story. You worked very hard. So could you go into your background a little bit about what your training regimen was like as a kid? And of course, listeners always like to hear any tips, anything that really helped your chess game along the way, but also just sort of the lifestyle of what it was like to be sort of a top young player pursuing education and chess.
Yep. Well, before I got into the national team, because when I got into the national team, they will handle me and, you know, provide me with good trainers and trainings and so on. But before that, I think I was around like 9 to 11 or 12 years old. Yeah, around those times, actually, there were golden years for me to improve, and my parents recognized this. So besides studying at the chess school where all the kids also did, my parents did something extra, that is to bring me around the train station. If you're Indonesian, you will know what I mean. Like the train station, the bus terminals, the markets, and so on. The idea is to get me to play against those players who I mentioned before, who don't play theoretical chess, but they have very good instinct in chess, especially in tactics. And of course, if you know theory very well, you could just punish them earlier in the beginning of the game. Because they don't know openings. But I was a kid, and my openings repertoire was also very limited. And this is actually a good training for me to widen my own repertoire. You know, not in the openings, but for characteristics. I mean, like if I play in some tournaments overseas, most of the players will just play some theoretical chess. But here, when my parents and my brother brought me to the train station playing against those people, and then it was very noisy as well, and the people, they were chattering and so on, you know, this is some train for me, not only for chess but also for the surrounding, like how to keep myself focused despite all this disturbance. And that's what I think is not you know, the other kids didn't do it. And I was very grateful that I already passed this period, because it's very important. It's a very important experience for me. And when my parents put me there, he would try to get me paired with somebody strong. And then if they could win against me, my dad would pay them some money. But if they lost against me, then that's nothing. It's fine. Because what we need is, you know, the experience to play. And then we don't seek winning. Yeah, we don't seek winning. We just want to seek the knowledge, you know, and then the experience itself.
And was that an attitude that you needed to be taught? Because a lot of people, kids especially, especially those that gravitate towards chess, like they hate losing. So you're saying you were basically trained by losing. Your dad and your brother went out of their way to take you to places where you would play tough competition and lose lots of games. So was that something that just came naturally to you, where you would learn from it and move on? Or was there like a lot of sort of hard moments along the way where you had to get used to it?
Yeah. So since I was a kid, and when I chose this game, my parents, especially my dad, already taught me that in order to be a great player, you have to lose so many games, and they keep trying to give me some understanding on why they brought me to these places. Because of course, as a kid, you know, you want some comfortable places to play in, right? Not some place like that. But what they told me is that, you know, you play in this place first, and then when you go back to your own age group, to your classroom and so on, you'll be a lion. And you might be, yeah, you might be a cat right now, or, you know, some weak animal. But this is how you train yourself to be a lion. And then when you get back later, not against these adults, but against your age group, yeah, you'll be the top of your class. So something like that. So it motivates me, you know. And then they also taught me that, yeah, losing is fine. Losing is fine, because as a kid, my parents employed this type of reward and punishment system to the kids, to me and my brother, that if I did something good, of course, they would reward me. If I did something bad, they would punish me. And then when I lost my games, I wouldn't get punished every time. But my dad would see like how bad I was at my game. Like if I lost just because of, you know, some positional mistakes, you know, we can actually measure like how bad it is. But if I lost just because, okay, I blundered my piece right away, or just because I overlooked that my piece was under attack or something like that, that it would be a bad loss. And then he would punish me in such a way, mostly about exercising. But at that time, I didn't know. I didn't know that it was what he thought for the punishment. So after I lost such a game, my parents would brought me to some stadium, and then they would told me, okay, because you lost this game, you have to run a few laps or something like that. And so that was how I brought up, you know, not only in chess, but also they trained me to be really tough on my body as well, physically, because chess requires so much thing, you know, not only learning about the technique itself, but also that you have to keep being fit physically.
Wow, that's an insane story, Irene. Couple things. I mean, first of all, the fact that you were doing physical training was also, like, as a result of losing games, was probably good for your chess too. But here in the West, I feel like, especially kind of in modern times, less so like my parents' generation and going back, like that kind of very disciplinarian type parenting is sometimes frowned upon. How is it perceived in Indonesia, and how do you look back on it, like, now as an adult?
Yeah, I don't think, you know, I have a sister, a younger sister, 12 years younger than me. And of course, she didn't go through the same training like me and my brother, because it's just different era. Yeah, it's just different era. So maybe it's not very suitable right now, but the idea is clear that you need to do something extra if you want to be the greatest. The implication and how you do it, it's totally different. Depends on the place, the country where you live in, the culture that you're having, and so on. But the fundamental idea is there, that my parents did this, you know, that the other parents didn't do, so that I could go further than other kids. So I think the support of parents here is very significant into my achievements, because of course I couldn't do it alone, but this is what, you know, if I could look back on what my parents did to me, maybe sometimes I felt it was a bit too, how do you call it? Not vicious, but it was a bit too tough, yeah, on kids like me. I was not even 10 years old at that time, but. Right. But maybe I was already a very tough kid back then, because, I could remember that they called me very hyperactive, that I couldn't really sit still, that I would do something, climbing a wall, or, you know, climbing a tree, or playing bike for kilometers away, far away from home, just being very naughty. But maybe such mentality was already grown on me. And then my parents saw that this is the type of training that would fit in with me.
Wow, That's interesting. And your dad was a table tennis professional. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes. He has this athlete foundation within himself. So when I started playing chess, he could identify that I had the talent on chess. So that's why he told me to pursue it and then help me to do everything I have to do in order to be like a real athlete, you know? So I think it's a good thing to have my parents, especially my dad, as a former table tennis player, because not only chess, but he was also focusing on my physique.
Yeah. And I'm, again, especially in classical chess, stamina makes a big difference. So obviously you were working very hard, making great sacrifices, Irene, but in terms of the actual chess, like, and aside from the sort of what you describe as like the school of hard knocks, like Botvinnik getting the smoke blown in his face and blasting the music or whatever, but like, what about the actual grind of the study? Were you doing tactics puzzles? Was it mostly coaching that you were getting, or what were you doing to improve?
Yep. I read lots of books. I read lots of books before I got into the national team. I like history, but I don't really like reading chess books. So the way I try to trick myself is that I would find a book which has story in it. So mm-hmm. I would play along the games, but I would love the game to have like some narration to it. So not only the chess game, but I also can relate the story behind the games and so on. That would be interesting for me. Obviously I did lots of tactics, and as a chess player from Asia, I think it's very natural for us to be a good tactical player, and that was my initial characteristic in chess as well, that I like aggressive, open position chess and types like that. But now, I'm growing also on chess, that I have to be flexible when I have to play positional chess, when I have to play tactical chess. But tactics was, that was one of my main training back in the days. And I played lots of games. So not computer games, because back then I only played over-the-board chess. So I think my cycle was just there. I played lots of games. I analyzed with them, and also with my dad, who also not very bad at chess back then, and I also did tactics. So I think it helped, you know. And then when I got into the national team, they would help me with all these theoretical chess from the openings, and then the end games for sure, because we hired mostly Russian trainers, so I happened to learn the endgame first compared to the openings, and yeah, I think that was basically my routine. And just play a lot of chess, analyze, and tactics.
Yeah, and with a few books turned into stories thrown in. Can you think of any examples of books that you read that you kind of turned into a story? I know it was a long time ago.
Okay. Actually, such books would be like, I can't even remember now, but I read a lot of Infomatter, although there's no story.
That's tough to turn into a story.
Yeah, it's not a story, but if you see, before the games and after the games, there were like cross tables and so on. So that was my story, even though there were no words, but I could just find like, oh, for example, this is Hort versus Karpov, 81, and then I would just see the cross table. Oh, these are the players. Yeah, I recognize these players from the other games and so on. So I make my own story. Not that I make it up, but I'm just trying to relate one cross table to another, and then maybe from the chess magazines that I read as well. Oh, this is the story of that tournament. So something like that. But to get those stories, maybe not from books, because sometimes the chess authors, they don't really care about the narration, just the content itself.
Right.
So So most stories I just got from chess magazines, and I read lots of chess magazines. Even when I told my trainers right now, like, yeah, I know you from the 19 1994 chess magazines. Okay, I was 2 years old that time, but okay, I read it like a couple of years later when I started playing chess. Yeah, I just like all these stories, so that you know, I not only chess history, but I like history in general. Maybe that's why.
That's crazy. Yeah, and for listeners who aren't familiar, The Informator was basically like a chess periodical with just games in it, and as Irene mentioned, cross tables. So it took some imagination to turn that into stories. But like you say, the stories are in there. You know, just like when you look at a graph of a game, it sort of tells the story, like a computer evaluation graph, which also didn't exist back then or barely existed. The cross tables tell a story as well. So it's cool that you were able to key in on that. So bringing it back to current days, Irene, you've got a couple tournaments coming up, and you're obviously super busy with a lot of professional opportunity and media requests like mine. So what are you working on now chess-wise? Are you able to train as well? And if so, what sort of stuff do you do?
Yeah, right now I am training with my teammates from the national team, because we are preparing also for one major event for our region, the Southeast Asian Games, that will happen in November, December, I guess, this year, in Vietnam. And that's usually being held once every 2 years. The last one was in the Philippines, and now it is in Vietnam. And Indonesia has been the overall champion for the past 2 SEA Games, so we are very happy. We're overtaking the other countries, and we are planning to defend it, of course, this year again. And so my teammates and I are training for that one, and Bill Open and other events on the way to SEA Games are our tryouts, you know, because we have to play anyway, because we've been idling for a year without any serious chess. I mean, online chess we play still, but you know, not over the board chess. So that's what we've been doing. We are playing training games, and then we're analyzing, and then yeah, just some normal stuff, you know. And everyone of us, we are also doing our own new opening repertoire and something like that.
Okay. Sounds like it's keeping you pretty busy.
Yep.
Cool. Well, we've got a listener question for you, Irene. And you had mentioned earlier how you want to be a role model for girls in particular, obviously in Indonesia, but throughout the world. And this one relates to women in chess. So this is a question from Stefan Bagria. For people who support Perpetual Chess via Patreon or PayPal, they can find out the guests and send questions in. So Stefan says, first of all, let me say just how much of an inspiration Irene is, and I imagine even more so in her native country. I'd like to hear her thoughts on what can be done to accelerate the inclusion of more and more women in chess. Is popularization enough to eventually bridge the numeric gap, or should FIDE and national federations also think of further incentives, like increasing prize pools and stuff like that? Is getting rid of separate competitions for men and women desirable, as some men claim would help?
Yeah. I think the foremost reason that you can get to popularizing chess among women is that to get a few stars already in it. Like, we already have Judith Polgar, like myself. How did I get into chess, and how did I get inspired into chess? Because I looked up at some figure. Some of them was Judith Polgar, for example, and also Maya Chibudanidze and so on. Maybe from the kids nowadays, the girls nowadays, they might look up at somebody like Haoyi Fan, right? And then Juwenjun or the Kosteniuk or the other Russians, yeah? So we already have stars like that, but what we have to do is just keep doing it. We have to get more names like that, and then not stopping there. So the girls can actually look up at them, and then be inspired, and then get themselves into chess. That's one thing. And another about prize money. Yeah, it is true that I've actually brought this up many times, not only in the national forum, but also to the international forum. For example, even though I'm in FIDE myself, sometimes I also have different opinion. For example, in the last Asian Nations Cup, there are some big difference, you know, in terms of prize money between men and women. We played on the same number of days. We played literally everything was the same. But yeah, if I'm not mistaken, it was like 70-30, you know, the division, and it was really not great. If it was like 60-40, then it's fine. And I brought this up in the closing ceremony where everyone was finally backing me up, especially the woman. Yeah, you just need somebody to speak up for sure, because just being silent will not help. So I myself tried to speak it up, and maybe it will take some time for women and men to get equal in terms of prize money in chess, especially. But we are working towards it. And I hope it will be achieved soon, because right now I see that women has been improved so much. I mean, women's chess has been improved so much. I think it's just a matter of time that we can really get this dream into reality.
Okay, well, I'm glad to hear that you say you see a bit of progress, although I do wish it would go a little faster. And of course, in your Ladies' Night interview with Jen Shahadi, you guys talked about Queen's Gambit a little bit. Have you seen the effect of that even in Indonesia? And do you feel like it's affected you personally, Irene?
Yes. Obviously, it's a great promotion for chess, because during the pandemic, everyone, I think, was just, you know, they're mostly at home and, of course, watching, right? And then the timing of the Queen's Gambit was just perfect, I guess. I think it was in October or November last year. And then everyone was just talking about it. And especially in Indonesia, it's just like one after another. And when the euphoria about the Queen's Gambit was not finished yet, and then there was a case between me and the Wakifas. So, I'm happy that the Indonesian people still got entertained after a few months. But I was projecting myself to not stopping there. I mean, chess promotion has to be continued always, and the good way to do it is just, you know, to get achievement of yourself first. Like what I said before, to be an inspiration to others, along with all these chess projects that I've been doing so far. But I have to prove to others that this is me, a chess player, a female. I can get my education in the U.S. And it was a scholarship, and I am also a grandmaster. And financially speaking, I'm quiet enough. Like, I don't really have any problem with that. So I just have to prove these all key elements to people who are doubting chess, especially girls who play chess. So, yeah, first of all, you just have to be a living proof, and everything will be taken care of by themselves.
Yeah, that's great advice. And that's certainly, like you say, people like Judith Bogar have blazed the trail in that regard. Irene, we got more to talk about. Speaking of the Dua Kipas match, I think it's time to dive in. But first, let's take a break and hear from our friends at Chessable.com. This is your weekly reminder that Chessable.com has a ton of high-quality material. Whether you're looking to learn a certain opening, want to see the latest Super GM repertoire that has been published, want to find a tactics course appropriate for your level, whatever it may be, go to chessable.com and have a look around. Don't forget they have tons of cool free content too, like their short and sweet courses about various openings. And all of the things that they offer feature their proprietary move trainer technology, the secret sauce that lets you actually remember all of the new chess moves and opening sequences that you learn. So once again, chessable.com, check out their ever-expanding excellent library. And we are back, and we are going to dive into this story again that Irene has talked about so much. So, Irene, I feel like, again, a lot of listeners might have caught wind of this. A lot of people probably even saw your most viewed match of all time, which, by the way, 1.25 million viewers, and somehow I wasn't one of them. So, so it could have been even bigger because I should be watching. But do you want me to sort of give the very brief version of the story, or would you prefer to? It's up to you, because I know you're probably tired of of discussing it in so much detail.
No, you can go ahead. I'd be curious to see it from your point of view.
Okay, and you'll be my fact checker, okay?
Okay.
All right, so I am Levy Rosman, aka Gotham Chess, of course, one of the most popular YouTubers and streamers in the world, is playing on stream, and he's playing an Indonesian gentleman who beats him in what's considered suspicious style. Basically, he's taking the same amount of time for every move, whether it's an obvious recapture or not. And Levy reviews his game history on chess.com, and it turns out that the guy had a very stable rating, I believe around 1700, I'm not sure about that. And then all of a sudden just took off like a rocket and is playing like, you know, 95 or 98 plus rated games, you know, on the algorithm that rates the quality of your game, just game after game. So no one knows for sure in these cases, but it's very suspicious. It would be the first time in history that someone had just like snapped their fingers and made a jump in chess strength like that. So Levy kind of makes jokes on stream, as far as I know, about the guy being a cheater. And then Levy gets some vicious backlash from a lot of Indonesian chess fans. And he's being harassed online. His girlfriend is being harassed online. This is in subsequent days, obviously, not at the same time. The guy vociferously denies cheating. And eventually, you speak up and just say, you know, from my perspective as a top chess player, it does seem suspicious. So you're trying to defend Levy and to kind of calm down the angry mob, as it were. And eventually, first of all, you go on this like huge podcast in Indonesia. What's it called? Close the door.
Close the door.
All right, I got it. So you go on the Close the Door podcast, which you and Jen liken to something like the Joe Rogan show, just huge popularity, general interest podcast, talk about it, and then end up playing a match, in real life, over the board match against this gentleman, Dua Kuipis, for pretty high prizes, as we will discuss shortly. And you win the match easily, and things have maybe died down a bit from there. So how did I do, Irene?
Pretty good, but maybe I modify a little bit. It's not the Indonesian chess fans, because if they're really chess fans, they wouldn't really be angry at Levy. It's just the Indonesian, we call it netizens, you know, the Indonesian internet users, because the chess fan itself, like, for example, when I was playing this match, I think almost all Indonesian chess communities would be giving their support to me, because as real chess fans, they know which side they have to go for. So it's basically the angry mob. They're just the Indonesian internet users, the netizens, we call it. So yeah, that's pretty much it.
Okay, not bad. Mm-hmm. And again, chess.com wrote a very good big article about this. You and Jen covered it at length. So I don't want you to have to rehash the exact same things. But one question I have, Irene, is like, has there been any new developments in the story since your interview on the Ladies Night podcast? Any new fallout? Have you heard from people? Any new opportunities? Stuff like that?
No, it's pretty much the same about the case. There's no development about it. But what we can take out from the case is just the chess Indonesia has gotten bigger and bigger. And even now, I think chess has been viewed differently from before. Like, before, chess was seen as you read in Jakarta Post, right? Just a game in post ronda, and then, you know, this chess cover and so on. But now, as I brought chess to the attention, that how chess professional is doing and so on, I think they treat chess differently, as they gain respect on chess. Chess players are really, you know, if you're a chess professional, they can really be a scientist, or, you know, because they're kind of doing research all days and so on. But I think it's just, you know, how people see it, and then it would change, completely changing how chess will be perceived. So I'm just, we actually, the Indonesian chess community right now are just trying to enjoy the moment, because we haven't seen the peak of chess like this before.
Well, that's good to hear. And I know you do some streaming. I believe you told Jen you stream primarily in English. Do you get much interest from Indonesian new chess fans or chess fans generally when you do stuff like streaming?
Yes, definitely. I only stream in English before, but then since the case with me and Dewa Kipas, there are more and more Indonesian chess fans coming into my stream, and then they asked me to also do some Bahasa Indonesia streaming, which I finally taking turn between English and Bahasa, something like that. So, and sometimes they told me that, yeah, I registered on Twitch just because I want to see you streaming and something like that.
Wow.
So, and now I'm just directing myself to YouTube. I'm also a content creator for chess, obviously, but strictly in Bahasa. I only did a little clips from Twitch streaming to YouTube, but if I did something for YouTube, it's just some chess contents like what others do. Like my friend Eric Rosen also did so many chess videos, and of course Levy himself, but they're in English. So what I'm doing is I'm doing things like this, but in Bahasa Indonesia.
Okay. Yeah. And obviously big country, a lot of opportunity, especially for someone as accomplished and well-known as yourself. And Irene, are you spending all of your professional time on chess? Do you still do any work in any other fields?
Currently, no. I think all my jobs and all my projects are related to chess strictly. I'm in FIDE right now in the PDC, the Planning and Development Commissions. And I'm a counselor for the Asian continent. That's because of chess, of course. And all other projects that I've been taking so far, they are mostly because of chess. So I think chess has given great opportunities that we haven't seen before. And this is something that I try to do, just not only for myself, but also to others who also pursue chess, that to show them, like, look, chess is not only what you see on the board, but there are more to it off the board as well.
Yeah. Yeah, that it's great. It's great that you shine that light. And you mentioned, of course, being friends with I Am Eric Rosen. I know you guys have collaborated on some Twitch streams and stuff like that. Does as someone who's kind of blown up in the chess world, has Eric given you any useful advice that you could share in terms of you're bringing your chess content to the Indonesian chess fans?
When I decided to start streaming on Twitch, or pretty much entering the streaming world, I talk to Eric almost every day, even until today. Yeah. Unless we're not busy. But he always gave me so many great insights, and I'm very newbie at first, but now I'm catching up, and maybe I'm still not as good as him, but at least I know how things work. He has given me so many priceless insights, where you can only get it through seminars or some other coachings,
right? Yeah, most people, it's like a stock professional trading stocks or something. Like, if they know something of true value, they're not super incentivized to share it. And Eric, as much success as he's had, luckily you're good friends with him. But I've got to follow up, Irene. Can you think of anything specific, anything that he said that, like you said, oh, I'm having this problem, this technical problem, or I'm not reaching this segment of the people, where he was able to give sort of specific advice to help you?
Specific advice, probably more technical, like how to set this up, how to get all the themes appearing or something like that. But what he has been doing so far, besides teaching me something that I didn't know before, he's also very supportive. Like, for example, when I told him that, okay, I think I'm going to also do some YouTube content. And then he said, okay, go for it. And then after a while, I gave him like some regular report, like, okay, up to this month, I got this many subscribers and this and this and this. And he was very supportive, saying like, oh, it took me about 3 times that length to get that many subscribers or something like that. Or,
oh, wow.
It took me, you know, a few months to get that type of donation or anything like that. And he was trying, you know, to keep pushing me that, okay, I can do better and better. And then, of course, when we are doing these chess videos and so on, like he told me, yes, it makes sense that you do this in Bahasa, you know, that like what he clearly told me is that I don't see anyone as in other streamers as my competition. I'm very happy to help them. And that's what he's been not only telling me, but I think his viewers also see this because he's known to be very helpful to other small streamers, you know? And then, yeah, I think that's why people love him.
Yeah, of course. Shout out to Eric, supporter of the podcast. So there's just one of what I'm sure are many, many examples. And of course, he's been on the show. As well. Well, that's awesome to hear. And Irene, are you happy with how your YouTube channel and your Twitch audience are going? Do you feel like it's a fruitful investment so far?
Yeah, I think they've been very great. I really love interacting with people when we're talking about chess. It's also, you know, it has given me so many insights because there are so many people coming from all over the world. And then I love geography as well because I love visiting new places and so on. So we can share stories about their own places and it's been fun. But I haven't really streaming on Twitch lately due to some personal reasons and also because of my busy plans so far this month. And I don't know when I'll be coming back streaming again. Because the World Cup is coming and then it's time for me to be like a serious chess player right now, not only for the promotion or for the fun, but now it's serious time.
Well, good for you. I know that has to be a hard balance to strike between, because like any gain you get, especially financially from like, increased chess strength or a better showing at a tournament isn't going to be the same as like growing an audience of your own, but chess is what got you here and chess is what you love. So mm-hmm. It's good that you maintain that focus.
Yeah. So
getting back to the Dua Kaipa story, we have one more Patreon mailbag question. Mm-hmm. This one is from Frederick Ryan. And Frederick says, is the money you receive for winning your match against Dua Kaipa the most you've ever received for winning a chess event? And if you don't mind saying, I mean, I think it's sort of public record. I believe it was around $14,000. Is that right?
Yep.
Yeah. So that's a big payday, right?
Yeah, it was a big payday. But to be honest, when I got it, I only felt relief. I didn't really feel like, oh, I'm gaining 14K. You know, I didn't think it financially. It's just I was so much under stress prior to the match, and I was just very happy that it was ended in my favor. But to answer your question, no, that's not the biggest prize money I've ever received. I know it might sound strange because Indonesia is not like really a chess country, but chess in Indonesia is quite appreciated in comparison to other sports as well. So, for example, we have this National Olympics. It's pretty much like the Olympics, but only for Indonesian, the Indonesian provinces. And then the bonus of the gold medal sometimes can be up to, let me check. It's up to 50 million rupiah, so for maybe around 40K or something. So, that's
14 or 40 or 1-4?
40.
Wow. Amazing.
Yeah, it's up to, because sometimes I... my province only has about 14K for one gold medal, but sometimes within one event like this, I could get like 5 gold medals. So you can do the math. And I think that's one of the main reasons that I skipped Olympiads. The last Olympiads, the chess Olympiad that I played was in 2014 in Tromsø, Norway. And then I didn't play any Olympiads after that in 2016 because I was in the States. I think I was doing my final exam or something, and I couldn't represent my country for the Olympiad. And also sometimes it's because it's clashing with the National Olympics. Then, even though I'd love to play in the Olympiads, but yeah, you cannot waste this type of opportunity because it's only being held once every 4 years, this National Olympics.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And will you be playing, is it coming up this year?
It was supposed to be played last year in 2020, but because of the pandemic, it gets delayed until this year. So this year we have so many major events, World Cup and then the National Olympics somewhere in September, October, and then the SEA Games. And this SEA Games itself, I didn't win any gold medal in the last SEA Game in 2019. But those who won the gold medal, they got the bonus from the government for 500 million rupees. I think I have to do the math. I think it's about 40K mm-hmm. or something. Yeah, that's big. So, but it doesn't happen like continuously every year, right? We just have to wait for this event so that we can get this type of payment.
Right.
But that's how chess in Indonesia.
Well, I mean, first of all, that's great to hear. I wish there were that level of support in many more countries. Mm-hmm. And as you say, the work you're doing to popularize the game, you know, getting that kind of financial support can only help continue to grow chess in Indonesia, which obviously helps to grow chess everywhere else. So that's great to hear. So one more follow-up, Irene, on the Dua Kuipis story, because when you did the interview with Jen Chahadi, mm-hmm. you mentioned that you were about to do what sounded like a crazy event to me. You were going to go in you were going to ride with a race car driver and play a blindfold chess game
yep.
while doing the race.
Yep.
So you're sitting here, so you survived, first of all.
Yeah.
I'm glad to see that. How did the chess game go?
Oh, it happened. It happened. And it was... So I was seated in a car, in a drifting car with a professional drifter. And there was another person in the tent, and we're communicating via earphone or something. And there was internet installed in the car as well. So whenever he played the move, the moderator will, of course, announce which move was that. And I would immediately say my move. But it turned out very crazy because normally during the drifting session or competition, normally you just do it for like 3 minutes, 5 minutes tops, because otherwise the tires will be exhausted and then it will not do good for the machine as well. But turns out during the match, we took more than 15 minutes and I got very... very sick. I almost puked in the car.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
Yeah, because once I started thinking and suddenly the car was drifted to the other corner, I was like so shocked, and then I had to remember all the moves again and so on. And I actually almost lost in the game, but I managed to draw it. It was such a crazy game. Yeah. I think at some moment I just blundered the piece just because it was already more than 10 minutes. It was very hard to keep your focus in such a situation. But everything turned out to be great because after that we got this award from Indonesian Record Museum that this is the first thing that has ever done in Indonesia that playing the blind chess in a drifting car.
I would think so. That is crazy. Now, if someone asks you, Irene, I mean, obviously this is a landmark story, this Dua Kuipis thing, one of a kind in chess history. But if someone asks you, what was the craziest experience of all that you had, is that number one, the car racing, or the blindfold chess while in a drifting car, or is there something that tops that for you?
I think the most memorable is the bullying.
Yeah,
it's prior to the match. It's not after the match. I mean, what happened after the match is just all good, you know. Like, even if I say something wrong, one word wrong, it doesn't matter. But before the match, even if I did or said something right, every story will be twisted according to the media, you know, and then according to what people want to hear. And that was, it was a very tough moment for me. I know people would be just, it's all right, you know, everything is okay now. But when you were in my shoe that time, I don't know. I cannot really explain anymore because,
I mean, we're talking about millions of people. I mean, over a million people watch. So that scale of people, obviously, it's going to bring out some crazy folks. And I'm sorry, and I don't mean to make light of the whole experience because I know that you had to endure a lot. And you and Jen talked about the cyberbullying that you had to endure, and you gave some good advice for other people having to deal with sort of trolls. Mm-hmm. And obviously, Levi Rosman, I mean, he had to shut down his channels for a few days. His girlfriend was threatened. Mm-hmm. So it is important that we mention that. And, I don't know what the broader lesson is from it, unfortunately. I mean, it's just, but that doesn't sound like that sounds pretty scary, honestly.
Yeah, but what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, right? So
yeah,
But I think I was prepared to do something like that. You know, I mean, all my life it was not very easy to get to where I am mentally, mostly because chess is a male dominant world, and of course Indonesia as well, and. When I was growing up and starting to play chess, all the tournaments have been played mostly, you know, just against male, pretty much, and adults. So, and also the training that I had from my parents playing in a train station or bus terminals or, you know, with all these people, I think it was some sort of preparation as well to have a better mentality. So I think I handled everything quite well that time, and it didn't really affect my playing. In fact, during the match, I was very focused, and I didn't allow anything to distract me mentally and physically. And I think with patience that I had, this is the fruit that I reap right now.
Yeah. Well, I'm first of all glad that you're healthy and have come through it. And yeah, as you say, just reward to get the attention and the prize for all that you endured and for having the bravery to speak up. Obviously you weren't like financially motivated at that time. You just saw the story and, you know, you're in a unique position with your level of knowledge of chess and your platform to set the record straight about what was going on with the veracity of the cheating allegations, the fact that, an experienced chess player knows what someone looking from the outside does not know, especially if it's being misrepresented in the media. So thank you for doing that, Irene.
No worries.
Okay, so I'm about ready to wrap up, but we're going to take one more break, Irene, and hear from my friends at aimchess.com. Not every chess player has a janitor to help them improve at chess like Beth Harmon did. For those of you who don't, there is aimchess.com. Aimchess has a web-based algorithm that collects and analyzes your games from chess.com or Lee Chess, and then it creates personalized study plans based on your weaknesses to help you improve. It might highlight specific openings to work on, tell you to tighten up your tactics, or in my case, tell me to manage my time better. Then it gives you puzzles and advice with the goal of helping you improve your chess faster. You can check out Aim Chess for free. And then if you decide to subscribe, please use the promo code CHESS30 to save 30%. That's CHESS30. The details are also in the show notes. So for now, let's get back to the interview. And we're back. So Irene, I feel like we've covered the broader points. I know you've done a lot of media, so I want to thank you for your generosity with your time. But before we go, I'd just like to hear a little bit more about what your life is like. I've been to a decent number of countries, but I've never been to Indonesia. So do you live in the city or the suburbs? And what's your daily existence like outside of all the online stuff and celebrity that you have?
Yeah, not people know that I've been doing this pretty much before the case between me and Dewa Kipas. But right now it's just getting more frequent just because Chas has attracted so many attention. But this is not something new that I've been doing. So, yes, Indonesia is the biggest archipelago country in the world, and I'm a proud Indonesian, obviously. I was born and raised in Jakarta, the capital, but inside me, I'm always a country girl. So,
okay.
Yeah, I don't really like big cities. Even when I was in the US, I mean, New York or, San Francisco, you know, they always have their charms, but I always like countries like Switzerland and then just go away from Zurich because yeah. Zurich is just very crowded itself. So going to Interlaken or even Biel, I've played there a few times already and I always like the atmosphere. Yeah, so that's pretty much about me. I'm a city girl, but I like anything's quiet.
So you do live in the city, but you prefer the quiet life?
Yes, yes. I just have to live in the city because of my activities required me to do so and all the meetings and so on. It's impossible if I live outside the city. But if I could choose, like, for example, chess tournaments overseas, I would choose, for example, maybe not in Amsterdam, but somewhere else, you know, like outside the big cities, and then for example also in Germany, I don't really like Berlin or Frankfurt, but I like all these little cities like Bad Kissingen and like Erfurt is also big, but you know, all these cities that we just somehow pass by in the train,
right.
Yeah,
you prefer, in the U.S. they call it flyover country. You prefer the places that are sometimes flown over. Do you have a favorite tournament place, like venue that you've ever played at in all of your travels?
Venue? I don't really have a favorite venue right now, but I always want to play in Reykjavik Open. It's one of my dreams to play there. And because Iceland is also one of my favorite cities. My favorite countries. I was the one who brought Eric Rosen to Europe for the first time, and it was Iceland, you know, his first European country. And it was such a great country. We loved it. We visited the Bobby Fischer's tomb, and it was a great country, and because it was very quiet, I think that suits me a lot.
Yeah, the Blue Lagoon,
yes.
Nice.
And I also like New Zealand is very nice. I went there how many twice, I guess. Yeah, and the nature is so beautiful, so I'm more to like nature than the city or buildings. Yeah, Jakarta is very crowded with skyscrapers, which I don't really like, of course.
I can see Irene cringing as she says.
Yeah, and I also have a country house here, about 50 kilometers away from Jakarta. It's literally on a mountain, and if I'm not busy, I spend my days over there. Because I just need internet to connect me with the world. Sometimes you just have to have one-on-one meeting, you know, like you have to meet and something like that. And sometimes it cannot be done like that when I was there. So most of the time I'm just at the city.
Yeah, that's great. And last question, Irene, do you have any, what are your hobbies outside of chess? Do you have time for anything else?
I love watching movies. Yes, my friends know that whenever they suggest any movies, I would be like, I've watched that. I've watched that. So, yeah, it's a bit hard to watch movies with me because I would always already watch it. But I love reading books as well. I love history. So before the invention of Netflix, for example, I read books a lot, but nowadays sometimes it takes time, and sometimes I just like, you know, I like stories. I like stories, so I just want to get one story done within like 2 hours, and that's it. Because if you're reading books, it takes sometimes a few days. And what else do I like? Oh, and now I'm balancing my me time with coffee and tea. So I don't know. I'm more a tea person before, but I think the US has changed me into a coffee person because of all these assignments and so on that I had to stay up. Yes, and there was a coffee shop really nearby my campus that day. So yeah, I've been just piling myself with all these coffees and so on. So now when I'm back in Indonesia or after I graduated from the US, I just, you know, if you ask me right now whether I will choose tea or coffee, I don't know which one I would choose. But before, I would definitely prefer tea over coffee.
Okay, yeah, I'm team coffee as well, but I like them both as well as other forms of caffeine. Maybe you can join John Bartholomew in a quest to get sponsored by Starbucks. Bring coffee to the masses in Indonesia as you are popularizing chess.
Oh, I'm not going to agree with that because I'm trying to popularize the local coffee itself. So Indonesia.
Oh, good for you! Yeah.
Yes,
yeah,
Indonesia. You have no idea, Ben. Indonesia has so many good coffees, and I'm sure you have heard a few of them.
Yeah.
Right. Luwak coffee. You know about this?
That one doesn't ring a bell, but something Sumatra, I believe, is...
Sumatran coffee is different. They also produce like very good coffee. And Toraja, this is another part of Indonesia, which is in Celebes or Sulawesi. But Luwak coffee is something, you know, that this part of animal, I forgot which animal it is in English. So they basically eat the coffee and they poop it and then you think, okay.
I'm trying to get some intel for you while you tell this story. Go ahead.
Yeah. So for some people it might be a bit disgusting, but you don't actually eat the poop of the animal, but it's it will be processed, you know, like the hygiene will be of course tasted and everything else, so don't worry about that. But for some people it is a really good coffee, and I think it's mostly produced in Bali, if I'm not mistaken.
Kopi Luwak is a coffee that consists of partially digested coffee cherries which have been eaten and defecated by the Asian palm civet. Okay,
that's,
I can
very
see why
unique.
You couldn't come up with the animal. I'm hesitant, I have to say, Irene, but I do love coffee. So
yes,
I'll think hard about trying that. Okay, well, that's an excellent. What better note to end on than coffee beans that are defecated from an animal? So Irene, so you're on Twitter. You went from like a few thousand followers to like 20,000 in like, you know, 5 hours or something. You've got your Twitch channel, your YouTube channel. Of course, we'll be watching and rooting for you in your upcoming tournaments in Biel and at the World Cup. Anything else we need to do to keep up with what you're doing, Irene?
I'm mostly active on Instagram because that's what I think Indonesian people are most active to, besides YouTube. I think, the most common platform for Indonesian internet users right now, they're just Instagram and YouTube. So I'm trying to be active on both of them, especially to promote chess among the Indonesian peers. That's why maybe lately my postings have been mostly in Indonesian, just because how it is. But yeah, anyway, I will not stop promoting chess. Let it be another cheating scandal or not, I'll keep doing the chess promotion.
Glad to hear it. And thank you for doing this interview, Irene. And yeah, we will definitely be rooting for you. So it's morning here in the US, but have a good night there in Indonesia.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks, as always, to my producer, Matthew Passy. Thanks to you all for listening. And thanks to those of you who help spread the word, whether it be positive reviews on podcast platforms, telling friends, social media, all that stuff helps get the word out, and it is much appreciated. By the way, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at BennyFishel1. You can join the Perpetual Chess Facebook group to continue the conversation, sometimes even with that week's guests. The Perpetual Chess Instagram page is back in action as well, at Perpetual Chess. And you can also find all these links on the Perpetual Chess webpage, perpetualchesspod.com. But of course, the main purpose of these closing credits is to thank everyone who supports Perpetual Chess financially. Without you all, we would not be able to put out such a consistent and hopefully quality product. So thanks so much. It really means the world to me. And in particular, I would like to give thanks to the following people and entities, starting off with my friends at Chessable.com. Aside from that, I would like to thank David Lazarus of LazmanChess.com. He is the coach of Dave's Young Tigers on Lee Chess, our friends at Quality Chess Books, the Capital City Chess Club, the Abysmal Depths of Chess blog, Adapta Interactive Web Designs and Services, the Apprend Chess Twitch channel, A Needy Deer, Austin Clough, Benjamin Porto, Bill Sigler, Kathy Carr, Chad Oliver, the Charlotte Chess Center, the Chess Central's Chess Blog, ChessMood.com, Chris Flanagan, Chris Lott, Dan O'Hanlon, Daniel He, Danny Davidson, David Schreiber, I am Dimitri Schneider, I am Eric Rosen, Eric Tam, Ewan Richardson, Farhan Thawar, Faraz Sawaf, Gary Foreman, Glenn Downing, Greg Harfst, Greg Shahadi, Gregory Gulick, Guvin Manet, James Holyhead, James Kennedy, Jeff Martinson, Jens Green, Jeremy Nielsen, John Jernigan, John Rockefeller, John MacArthur, Kelly Palmer, Kevin O'Callaghan, King Selt, the King's Crusher YouTube channel, one of the original chess YouTube channels, Lucio Casada Silva, the law offices of Stuart Katz, Matthew Feeney, Michael Kahn, FM Michael Oblin, Mike Zelazny, Mr. Mike Shahadi, the legendary Mr. Dodgy, the NerdNaze Twitch channel, GM Peter Prohaska, Peter Sodhi, the Playmore Chess Academy of the Hamden Chess Club, Reuven Fisher, Reverend Roy Fry, the Seattle Chess Club, Shane Unger, Stefan Kelty, Stephen Martinez, Sven Gearson, Thomas Stanix, Thomas Tachenko, Todd Bryant of Strong Chess, Todd Kennedy, the Vintage Patzers, which is a chess.com improver group. You can look them up. Wayne Bean, William Hogarth, and I also would like to thank Aaron Waffler, Ace Viega, Adam Ralph of chessengland.com, Adrian Gutierrez, Al Hastings, Alan and Maggie Sue, Alex Pejas, Alexander Markovics, Antonio Cancino, FM Andre Tarakov, Dr. Andrew Perry, Angus McLeod, Barry Hessian, Bill Juniper, Bill Moran, Bill Trammell, Brad and Andy Rosen, Brett Howard Lynn, Brian Chase, Brian Mullis, Bruce Scott, Brian Tillis of Palm Beach Chess, Cameron Davis, Chad Hilton, Chess Potzer Spain, Dr. Charles Snodgrass, Chris Wainscott, Christopher Baumgartner, Christopher Shabri, Christopher Wood, I am Christoph Zalecki, also known as Chess Explained, Coach J's Chess Academy, Corey Butson, Costa Carras, Courtney Fry, Craig Mallon, Daniel Ginsberg, Daniel Naylor, Dave Saylor, David Bleskacek, David Brown, David Hamblin, David Cramley, Dalen Shelton, Dennis Parrish, Dirk Decker, FM Donnie Ariel, Dwayne Edmonds, Ed Daly, Ed Mead, Emmanuel Langual, Robitaille, Ethan Smith, Hallelujah Cat, Ian Mason, Fide Arbiter, Felipe Melo Pereira, Fox Valley Chess Club, Francis Letart Lavoie, Dr. Frank Tortoris, Frank Zananis, Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Gautam Narula, Geert Vandervelde, Gene Stewart, George Harris, Giovanni Russo, Han Schutt, Harish Srinivasan, Howard Vihan, Jacob Kovach, Jason Apollo, Jason Murray, Jacques Parry, James Aspinwall, James Benastia, James Muir, Jason Woolham, Jaydeep Chakrabarty, Jeff Anderson, Jeffrey Martello, Yep Hoyland, Jerry Wells, Jesse DeCumost, Jesse McNulty, Jim Ratliff, Joe DeSano, Joe Valdez, Joel Thomas Ramos, John Tooley, Juan Almaguar, Dr. John Fallon, John Fernandez, John Fontaine, John Hartman of US Chess, John Jeffrey, John McMurtry, Jonathan Slater, John Quist, John Tully, Jose Rodriguez, Justin Gardner, Jen Shahadi, Joel Rocky, John Thompson, GM Josh Friedel, IM Kare Christensen, WGM Katerina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, Kevin Pryor, IM Kostya Kovutsky of the Chess Dojo, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Kyle McAvoy, Larry Cook, Larry Reiforth, Laura Boyovsky, Macaulay Peterson, Mark Fitzpatrick, Mark Miller, Mark Wilkins, Marco Bulatovich, Martin Knudsen, Martin Krug, Matthew Passy, Matthew Tedesco of SeattleChessMeetup.org, Matthias Plock, Mechanics Institute Chess Club of San Francisco, Michael Allard, Michael Hudson, Mike Clem, Mitchell Fabian, Nate Goble, Nate Solon, Neil Bruce, Nigmat Malijanov, Nicholas Isabel, Olaf Mueller Michaels, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Passy Passanen, Paul Bain, Paul Clarkson, Paul Sweeney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Queenside Management Limited in Switzerland, Randy Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Richard Hollenbach, Richard Tucker, Robert Callahan, Robert Tichy, Robert Turner, Rory Coleman, Rory Yearwood, Ryan Berg, the Say Chess YouTube channel, Scott McKinnon, Scott Shepard, Sean Krause, Sebastian Finsterwater, Walter, Sergey Magakon, Seth Ruzicka, Shane Unger, Silver Knights in Richmond, Stefan Roller, WGM Tatyav Abrahamian, Tim Brennan of TacticsTime.com, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, FM Timothy Wall, Tom Edsel, Tomas Komanich, Tony Rattel, Tyron Price, Vishnu Srikumar, William Brock, William Peterson, FM Zhao Cheng of Chess1000.com, and last but never least, Zhivko Stoyanov. Thanks for listening, everyone, and we will catch you all next week.
Podcast Network.